Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York. Just wrapping up here, arguably the most dramatic public hearing of the January 6th Select Committee. It was jaw-dropping until the very last moment. Some big news, a bombshell there dropped by Congresswoman Liz Cheney at the end. But most of the hearing drilled down on what the members of the Select Committee have for months now been describing as the evidence they've garnered to describe the marshalling of the mob. When they say that, they mean the efforts by the twice-impeached ex-president, that would be Donald Trump, and his allies to assemble the army of insurrectionists that would ultimately storm the United States Capitol on January 6th. The committee today laid out that mountain of evidence showing that Donald Trump knew perfectly well he had lost the election. And yet he turned to those who told him what he wanted to hear. He forum shopped until the very last moment. At one point, he agreed to name conspiracy theorist Sidney Powell as a special counsel to investigate her audacious claims of voter fraud. It was at a December 18th meeting that became the focus of much of today's hearing. White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson, who we heard from in the last public hearing, described that meeting as unhinged in a text. The committee delved deep into the right-wing fever swamp that ensued at Trump's incitement. And the committee laid out all of the various ways that Team Trump was in tacit cooperation, not just day to day, but hour to hour, with the domestic violent extremists and white supremacists responsible for carrying out the violence on January 6th. And as we mentioned right at the top, at the very end of the hearing, Liz Cheney, with her bombshell, it's becoming a pattern for her. She revealed that Donald Trump called one of the witnesses. It happens to be a witness that she says we, the public, the viewing public, has not heard from yet. The witness had his or her lawyer call the committee, and Liz Cheney there publicly calling or sharing that information had all been turned over to the Justice Department. It's where we begin our coverage today with some of our most favorite reporters and friends. I pulled my friend and colleague Katie Turr over. She's been helming our coverage all day long. We're also joined by Frank Figluzzi, FBI Assistant Director for Counterintelligence and an MSNBC National Security Analyst. Also joining us, former Senator and MSNBC Political Analyst Claire McCaskill. Frank Figluzzi, I want to start with you on this bombshell. Do we have you, Frank? I saw Frank. Frank's not there yet. Claire, Liz Cheney, in what is becoming, I think we can call it on brand for her, revealing some really stunning testimony that Donald Trump himself engaged in what can only be described as witness tampering.
Yeah, I'm struck right at this moment, Nicole, with a stark realization. And that is everything we've heard in these committee hearings stands for the proposition that so far our rule of law has failed, because this man is continuing to use a seditious lie to try to hold on to power in this country, is illegally pressuring witnesses to not give testimony to one of the branches of government that has a sacred obligation to protect the Constitution. I mean, if you think about it, we have candidates all over the country proudly campaigning on this seditious lie. It is time. I feel very strongly that there is a mountain of evidence now about this man's state of mind and exactly what went down, and that when he couldn't do it legally, he said, screw the law. I don't care about the law. I want to hold on to power. And that is a crime.
Well, so much there to unpack in your one response, Claire. But I think in some ways, the quietest witness was the most tragic one. It was Mr. Ayers. He was one such radicalized Trump supporter. He described himself as a family man and a working man. He said everything about his life has changed. in an eerie way, there was an echo to a life being blown up based on a lie to some of the earlier witnesses. And I want to bring you in, Frank Figluzzi, on something we talk about all the time, the radicalization of Donald Trump's own base of supporters as casualties. He doesn't care about any of them. He doesn't care about Mr. Ayer's life being blown up. He doesn't care about the Oath Keepers, and I don't care about them personally, but all the legal problems they all have now are as a result of their adherence and belief in his lies.
Two witnesses so crucial to the counter-radicalization process, Nicole, that, yes, we've talked about before. People watching, Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, people who will at least sympathize, empathize with them, needed to hear today from people who've been there and done that. They needed to hear somebody say, I no longer buy into the big lie. I understand court after court after court rejected the big lie, the notion that there was fraud systemically that would have changed the election. And then Mr. Van Totenhove, who said, I fear for the next election cycle, because if Trump runs again, we have a president who can whip up a civil war. He talked about America being exceedingly lucky that there hasn't been more violence. He said, I have kids. I have a grandkid. He gets it. He's been there. Stuart Rhodes, Oath Keepers leader, had actually asked him to create a deck of playing cards like the U.S. military used to feature targeted international terrorists. And he wanted to put Hillary Clinton on one of those playing cards. We needed to hear that today, and we also all needed to hear, as we've heard about the dots being connected, we needed to see that those dotted lines become more solid lines between Trump and illegality, right? Rejecting the legal for the illegal, rejecting the rule of law for the rule of Trump. What's the rule of Trump? Get it done by any means necessary. If I don't hear what I want from official people and sources, I'll go unofficial. If that doesn't work, I'll go appeal to the public masses. And you're right, I don't care about those public masses.
Well, Frank, to your point about illegality, Pat Cipollone was worth the wait. He seems to have corroborated all of the evidence that we heard him respond to, that Cassidy Hutchinson had testified to in her public hearing as well as in her depositions. But he also painted a very clear picture, and there was a lot of talk about how robust his testimony would be. But when he describes basically an off-book set of presidential advisors who he didn't even know. I worked in the White House. To not know how someone gets in as the White House counsel is inexplicable to me. You have to be waved in. There's a waves office. You have to have a social security number. That the White House counsel had no idea how the Overstock guy who he didn't even recognize and Sidney Powell got into the Oval Office is a stunning piece of color at how off the books of government employees Donald Trump was turning to run a coup against his own government.
Well, you're right. From your own personal experience, my personal experience as assistant director for counterintelligence, numerous visits to the White House, right? Sometimes just waiting, being late for my meeting because they're still checking the roster, the record. Are all my clearances passed before I can get into the situation room? And we don't know how these people are traipsing in and out. And then we learn today that apparently Trump magically waved a wand and gave a clearance to Sidney Powell and then appointed her maybe to some kind of special counsel position. I mean, it is absolute lunacy. If that's how people want their government run, then keep doing that and you'll get that again, but you'll get more violence. You'll lose the rule of law. You'll lose our democracy. And ultimately, that's what Trump chose to do. He chose to do whatever was necessary to regain power, maintain power, but not to preserve the American way.
Okay, Frank and Claire, I'm going anywhere. I want to bring into the conversation NBC News legal analyst Neil Katyal. He's, of course, the former acting solicitor general. We have tons of questions for you about Frank's talking about illegality. But first, Katie, you helmed all the hours in here in the studio. I had on sneakers and sweatpants. I want to deal with two things with you. One, this bombshell at the end that Liz Cheney just dropped, that Donald Trump himself tampered with the witness?
That Donald Trump tried to call a witness. The witness called her lawyer or his lawyer, and that the lawyer told the committee, and the committee then referred it to the DOJ. We got a hint of something like this, not this exactly, the other week when Cassidy Hutchinson was testifying. Liz Cheney presented evidence that people in Donald Trump's orbit had tried to contact somebody. We learned it was Cassidy Hutchinson to say, we know you're a friend. Yeah. We know you're loyal.
Stay on
we
the
know
team.
You'll do the right thing. And they say they're taking witness tampering very seriously, and they're going to refer it to the DOJ. Let's see what the DOJ says about it. But this should not come as a surprise, because we've been watching the Donald Trump show now for 7 years, and we've heard this happen before with Michael Cohen specifically.
Right.
When he was, going against Donald Trump, he said he got pressured from that world. And I mean, listen, I think it's a lot to hear from all of these aides to the former president, Pat Cipollone, his White House lawyer, come out and tell the truth under oath about what was happening at the time.
Yeah.
You got to imagine that Donald Trump and the people around him right now, also a lot of those folks like Jason Miller, all the ones who already have testified, right, are saying we got to limit the damage.
Well, I also want to ask you about the meeting, because that made up really sort of the whole build of the first part of today was to this mash, basically, of the crazy December 18th meeting. But I want to get your thoughts on Pat Cipollone. He felt like someone who was pretending to be a reluctant witness, but looked like he was thanking God he finally had a chance to clear his conscience and tell his story.
I agree with that, Nicole, although I do think the key word in what you said there was finally. It's been 18 months for Pat Cipollone to come and tell the truth. I mean, we had a whole impeachment in which he was nowhere.
So when he defended Trump in the first impeachment.
Exactly. But in the second one, when none of this story came out. And so, you know, I commend him. It's really great. The last thing he should get is a Presidential Medal of Freedom, as was suggested, or something.
That was for Pence.
Oh, that was for Pence. That was him suggesting
his nomination.
Pence.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, maybe by these bottom feeder standards, I guess all these people get medals or something like that. But, you know, it's good that he's come forward. And what Cipollone really painted was a crazy White House. I mean, what you were saying before about waves is 100% right. The White House counsel has to know everyone who comes in, how they come in. The idea that you have this, you know, motley crew, you know, Star Wars bar scene of people on December 18th, from Michael Flynn to, you know, to Sidney Powell, all there in advising the President of the United States.
By the way, Sidney Powell gets in the diss of the whole hearings when she says Pat Cipollone ran faster than the sound of light or something. I want to delve into the testimony now. I know you've all been watching, but let's go through some of it with all of our experts. This is SOT 1. This is Powell and Cipollone describing this unhinged, Neil Katyal's words, Star Wars bar meeting at the White House.
Did you believe that it was going to work, that you were going to be able to get to see the president without an appointment?
I had no idea.
In fact, you did get to see the president without an appointment.
We did.
How much time did you have alone with the president? And I say alone, you had other people with you, but
right
from his aides before the crowd came running?
Probably no more than 10 or 15 minutes.
Was in that?
I bet Pat Cipollone set a new land speed record.
I opened the door and I walked in. I saw General Flynn. I saw Sidney Powell sitting there. I was not happy to see the people in the Oval Office. Well, again, I don't think they were providing. Well, first of all, the Overstock person, I never knew who this guy was. Actually, the first thing I did, I walked in, I looked at him, and I said, "Who are you?" And he told me. I don't think any of these people were providing the president with good advice. So I didn't understand how they had gotten in.
There it was. Still stunning. You're watching it played back and having processed it. Talk about what this means, though, in terms of potential criminality, not just for the president, we'll get to that, but for all the people involved in the coup plot.
I mean, it's looking very bad for all of them. But let me actually start with the president, because it follows directly from that quote that we just saw. Because what it shows is that Sidney Powell, the president, orchestrated to name her special counsel. The idea that she's special counsel to anyone is frightening, but particularly to the United States government. And one of the questions in the case has always been, did Trump try and use his powers in some way to interfere with the election? The idea that he was putting Sidney Powell, someone who said all sorts of crazy stuff, in is a direct attempt to interfere with the outcome of the presidential election. It's his fingerprints, not someone else. Sidney Powell said she wasn't sure whether she was actually appointed or not, but it sounds like she thought she was. I mean, if you don't know whether you're appointed or not as special counsel, you're probably not a very good special counsel. But the fact is, it looks like Trump made those efforts. That was all part of this plot to, as you say, a coup against his own government.
Frank, I want to ask you about the significance in terms of what this committee and its investigators, who we should always point out, are from U.S., they're former U.S. attorneys, they're former AUSAs. This is what they do. But in terms of the evidence, my jaw dropped when they said, we're going to tell you about this meeting. We talked to six people who were in it. I think there were only eight in it. What do you do with that evidence over at DOJ?
This is a great question. You heard Claire say that there's now a mountain of evidence pointing to the president, and I totally agree with that. But I think Claire would also agree, because she's a former prosecutor, with the understanding that prosecutors must show evidence of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's quite clear that this mountain of evidence absolutely predicates the opening of an investigation with Donald J. Trump's name in the title of it. That is my absolute opinion, that we have clearly enough for DOJ to open that investigation and clearly put the former president's name in the subject line. That I've got. Now, with regard to the dotted lines becoming solid lines that point to the president in a way that is beyond a reasonable doubt, or at least would convince a grand jury to indict, we still have to look at this notion that the president will likely say, you know, I thought there was fraud. I didn't buy into all the official people, and now there's a litany of them, right, who told me, from the Attorney General of the United States to the White House counsel, who said, yeah, it's not there, it's not there, it's not there. And I chose to go with basically a bunch of people who are crazed and pursue that. But there's a mountain of evidence, as Claire says, that he chose that deliberately. He knew he was doing wrong. And in fact, he jettisoned even crazy lawyers and went to a public appeal. And that's where it gets really interesting. What did we hear today? Two calls with Steve Bannon on January 5th. After the first call, Steve Bannon goes public and describes the call and says, what? All hell's going to break loose tomorrow. That's a great piece of evidence. But it's got to get us to a case and then to a grand jury and then to a conviction. It's a challenge, but they need to take that challenge on for the sake of democracy.
Well, and Claire, Liz Cheney started the day making that challenge. I think we have this part of her opening statement where she says Donald Trump is I won't swear on TV today because you and I did that yesterday, a grown man, not a 12-year-old child. He knew exactly what he was doing. Do we have that? Let me play that for you, Claire.
President Trump is a 76-year-old man. He is not an impressionable child. Just like everyone else in our country, he is responsible for his own actions and his own choices. As our investigation has shown, Donald Trump had access to more detailed and specific information showing that the election was not actually stolen than almost any other American. And he was told this over and over again. No rational or sane man in his position could disregard that information and reach the opposite conclusion. And Donald Trump cannot escape responsibility by being willfully blind. Nor can any argument of any kind excuse President Trump's behavior during the violent attack on January 6th.
Claire, she laid it out there, as you might have if you were on that committee.
Yeah. She one thing she referenced there was a concept in the law called willful ignorance or willful blindness. That's not a defense in the law. you can't ignore the facts and then claim because you ignored them, somehow you're not guilty. And let me just lay this out clearly. I get what Frank's saying, but here is what I see. I see a man being told over and over again that there is no evidence of fraud, being told over and over again that he lost the election. Even his own crazy, weird, dye-dripping Rudy Giuliani admitted that they did not have evidence of a fraud. His own crazy, incompetent lawyers knew they didn't have evidence of a fraud. And then you have the December 16th draft executive order. If I were putting this case together, I would say that was the beginning of the conspiracy. They drew up this order to have the Secretary of Defense seize property without probable cause, without any evidence, which is wildly illegal in this country. And then in the meeting, in this executive order was about appointing a special counsel. So in the meeting, we now have Trump saying these people aren't giving me what I need and appointing crazy Sidney Powell as special counsel. That is a conspiracy to do something illegal. In fact, to do something that is the most serious crime, I believe, that can be committed in this country. And that is to steal a presidential election. So I really think there is enough evidence here to indict. Now, will he be convicted? I don't know. But the risk of not indicting, I think, is so grave to this country in terms of respect and accountability under the rule of law. I just think it is a big risk to not do it. There may be jury nullification. There might be somebody on the jury that is a Trump supporter and they refuse to convict. But I think that's a risk that we have to take under the laws of this country.
Well, and the public pressure for accountability now transcends a right-left paradigm. I mean, it really, and the committee laid out more evidence of the coordination between Trump and the extremists. I want to play for you, Katie. This is Congresswoman Murphy. This is SOT number one on my list. This is her talking about the riot organizers saying that the president was planning to have them march to the Capitol, but wanted it to look spontaneous. So they were even in on how they sold that speech on the ellipse. Let me play that.
The organizer says, you know, this stays between us. We're having a second stage at the Supreme Court again after the ellipse. POTUS is going to have us march there / the Capitol. It cannot get out about the second stage because people will try and set up another and sabotage it. It can also not get out about the march because I will be in trouble with the National Park Service and all the agencies. But POTUS is going to just call for it, quote, unexpectedly. The end of the message indicates that the president's plan to have his followers march to the Capitol was not being broadly discussed.
Well, we know that that's spot on, that it wasn't in his prepared remarks. He adds it. Cassidy Hutchinson can't even hear it. So when he says we're going to march to the Capitol, an angry Kevin McCarthy calls her phone. Do you think they have the answer to how the organizer knew just what Trump was going to do?
So that is one of the bigger questions. So Lindell says this. And then Alexander says this as well, that she's expecting Donald Trump to say that also. And the question is, how does that get from Donald Trump spontaneously saying it to them knowing about it? Was there a phone call? Are there White House logs that show those conversations? I don't know if we're going to hear recordings of those conversations to get those concrete details. But I just wonder if we've just lowered the bar for Donald Trump over the years about what his intent is. I mean, I've covered him now since 2015. Mm-hmm. And it seems pretty clear that there's causal relation between what he says and what people do. I've saw it at the campaign trail, at the rallies, punch him in the face. That happened.
Right.
We saw it during these years in the White House. We see it with the insurrection. One plus one equals two. Right. Donald Trump says, go to the Capitol. We'll be wild. I know these people have weapons. I don't care. They're not out to get me, according to the testimony from Cassidy Hutchinson. One plus one equals two. Have we lowered the bar so much that we need more evidence for Donald Trump than we need for anybody else in our society? And under any other circumstance, a person like this, were it not Donald Trump, would have been cast off long before now. He's just defied expectations for so long and lowered the bar so many times. that it seems like we're putting him in a special camp where he is the only person that gets to do these things and get away with it.
Gets to break the law and get away with it. He might be the only person for whom there are two volumes of crimes he committed for which he was never charged with anything.
And I'd say, like, far from being an ordinary person, he's the president of the United States. You worked in the White House. You know every word a president says matters so much. People hang on to it. They take inspiration from it or direction from it. I mean, even if a president pauses in a speech, that has enormous practical significance on the ground. To have a president saying all this and these crazy tweets on December 19th following the Star Wars bar scene meeting on the 18th is really, I mean, it is the height of irresponsibility. It's a man saying, I care about me. I care about my position. I don't care about the country. I don't care about electoral processes and the right and the like. That's why I think Claire's point is so important. You know, it might have been one thing before the hearings. Maybe we could have pretended all of this didn't happen. The impeachment, the second one wasn't a success. But now the American people know. They know what Donald Trump did. And it's not just, you know, like public. It's Trump people themselves now. Yeah. And they're starting to switch. You have to indict if you're Merrick
Garland. Can I just add something? Over the summer of 2020, excuse me, right before the election, when Donald Trump was rallying and saying the only way that I could lose is
if it's rigged, if there's fraud.
I went to a rally in Pennsylvania and I talked to a bunch of people outside of it and I asked him, you know, what happens if Donald Trump loses? And every single person I spoke with said, there's no way he could lose. Right. This is in the summer. There's no way he could lose. It's not possible. And I said, but what if he does? Well, it'll get fixed. Don't worry about it. The law enforcement will come in and fix it. I asked one gentleman, I said, well, what will you do if you believe democracy has been stolen from you if Donald Trump loses? And he told me that he would be willing to take up arms. This was in the summer before the election. So we saw this coming for many, many months. And he tried this also in 2016 when he thought he was going to lose, even on election day when he saw that the polls were not coming in his favor. He said there's fraud in this one county. He began it. He began to already cast blame around. And then when he realized he was winning, he stopped that and said it was free.
But he did investigate fraud because he lost the popular vote. Didn't he have the guy from Kansas?
He tried.
Yeah, he tried. I want to ask you, Frank, about this point that Katie's making. There's a mistake in Trump's sort of slovenly manners to think that everything's a wild coincidence. But the committee has had so much evidence, and we'll actually get to speak to Congresswoman Murphy in a few moments. They have such mountains of evidence of premeditation and foreknowledge. I mean, everything that happened on January 6th was planned and was so exciting to Trump that he shot out a 1:47 a.m. tweet, which even for him, like Katie, I've followed his tweets for too many years, was a very sort of uncommon hour of the day to tweet. But the plan was burning inside him after meeting with all of his crazy advisors. I wonder if there's enough evidence in your mind of the planning for the violence, and now that we know so much knowledge of the violence, and what Cipollone testified to was precisely what Cassidy Hutchinson testified to, which was not just acquiescence and acceptance of the violence, but enthusiasm for it. How is there not an investigation into his role in the actual violence that was carried out against the law enforcement officials?
Yeah, we don't know what we don't know. There are grand juries sitting. I'm concerned that there's not enough happening fast enough. Katie's absolutely right that the notion of fraud, a distrust in the electoral process has been planted long ago. And, you know, you fast forward to putting people in strange places with just a couple of weeks left in his administration. Why is he changing out people at DOD? Yeah. Why does he insert somebody in the general counsel's office at NSA? Why is he looking for a new acting attorney general? What is that about with days left in your administration? That's also something that really needs to get discussed as part of an overall plan to put the people in place that he needs. And it's still happening in plain sight. What do I mean by that? The notion of fraud, distrust in election outcome is now strategic. It's happening throughout the United States, whether it's Steve Bannon behind it or Proud Boys going local. We see what's happening with Secretary of State positions. We see what's happening with election offices at local, county, and state levels. You don't have to win in the upcoming midterms, you simply have to plant the seed of doubt enough so that people don't trust the election. And as the former Oath Keeper said today, we will have violence in the next election cycle. So it's happening in plain sight. It is a strategy. And that's very, very troubling. And it is evidence of intent. And I think the next hearing will talk about inaction. You know, we're talking about the president's actions all day today. Don't forget, almost as important is the notion of inaction as to intent. If someone's told you we've got violence on our hands, people are getting hurt, let's do something, and you then choose to do nothing, it's further evidence of your intention.
Neil, the committee has set expectations extremely high for itself. It felt again today between the live testimony, seeing Pat Cipollone for the first time, that the bombshell, some of the phone logs, some of those things that are really easy to wrap your brain around, that they again had more evidence than anyone thought they would, tying Trump to the actual violence and the extremists.
100%. And what they did at the end was tantalize us with next week, because what they said was, look, Pat Cipollone has come and sat with us for a long time. He's going to take us through the 181 minutes. The committee said they were going to go minute by minute while Donald Trump was sitting on his hands on January 6th, you know, and he could have done any number of things from calling the attorney general or the Department of Homeland Security. Evidently, Cipollone said he did none of those things, zero. So we're going to start, I think, hearing about that next week. And then there's the tantalizing thing, which you said, the bombshell at the very end, that Donald Trump himself personally called a witness who hasn't been publicly identified yet to the committee. Now, I suspect, you know, that's could be very serious witness tampering. I'm glad to see the Justice Department's already got the information. I suspect Donald Trump's defense is, hey, I didn't know she was going to be a witness or he was going to be a witness. Mm-hmm. You know, whether or not that can hold up, you know, there's probably parties to conversations, including this witness's own lawyer who may have been able to tell Trump. But that's going to play out. That could be a very easy criminal case if the evidence is the way that Congresswoman Cheney suggested it might be.
A very easy criminal case for the Justice Department to bring against Donald Trump?
Yes.
I didn't know there was such a thing.
Yes, because, witness tampering is pretty much, it's a pretty simple test. It's not the kind of thing in which you have presidential prerogatives. You know, this is Trump acting now as a private citizen. He's not the president. There's no possible privilege claims or anything like that. It's just simply, are you trying to prevent this person from coming forward to tell the truth? And do you have that mens rea? Is that your intent? If, depending on what that is, that could be pretty serious.
Oh, wow. All right. You blow my mind as usual. I know we lose you for a little bit, but you'll be back in the next hour. No cocktail. Thank you very much. Joining our conversation, Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy of Florida, member of the House, the January 6th Select Committee, one of the lead questioners this afternoon. We have been playing some of the most shocking things that happened today, but make our job easy for us. What for you is the piece of information that you would love to be on the local news tonight and every market in the country and in the newspaper tomorrow? What for you is the most important thing that people should have taken from this hearing?
I think the most important thing is that the president and his advisors all knew they didn't have the evidence that they had lost the election, and yet they misled people. And as a result of the lies that they told and the encouragement they gave to average Americans, as well as violent extremists, those people took actions. People died. People were injured, and some of these people's lives will never be the same. I think you saw from Mr. Ayers, he was just a Trump supporter and a family man who followed the direction of the president to come down to the Capitol. And now he finds that, you know, he's lost his job, and a lot of things have happened that have negatively affected his life because he believed in the lies of powerful people and the president.
You had so much evidence to impart on us in terms of the internal communications of the most senior White House officials and campaign officials. One of the most hair-raising was Brad Parscale's messages to Katrina Pearson, where they knew exactly how destabilizing Trump's conduct was. Can you characterize how it is that you elicit such frank testimony? Is there an unburdening that happens when people come before the committee?
Well, it is a combination of having received so many documents, text messages, and data points. And then we have phenomenal investigative attorneys who are then able to elicit, and as well as the members, when we are in those depositions, we're able to rely on the facts that we already know, previous witnesses' testimony, and then ask very targeted and pointed questions to elicit the information that we're looking for. It's like putting together a multi-dimensional puzzle, and we're bringing in bits and pieces from witnesses as well as documents.
Katie Turr, my colleague and I have been talking about this piece of evidence that you presented, tying the insurrectionists and the rioters to very intimate knowledge of something that was a very live and fiery debate within the West Wing, and that was whether or not in his speech on the Ellipse, Donald Trump would call on his supporters to march to the Capitol. Of course, he does. He says he will join them. An angry Kevin McCarthy calls Cassidy Hutchinson, we learned in one of the previous hearings. How much more evidence like that are you in possession of?
We have more evidence, but we pull the pieces of evidence that will make the point in the most direct way. But we have corroborated the fact that the president had long planned to direct people to the Capitol and just didn't tell people, wanted it to be a surprise or be unexpected of sorts.
Do you have more? Liz Cheney dropped a bombshell there at the end when she implicated Donald J. Trump in a witness tampering incident with a witness that she described as someone who you may all have heard from, but who we as a public have not heard from yet. Is there just one, or do you have evidence of more than one witness that Donald Trump has sought to interfere with?
We're not going to speak about the specifics as a committee, but what I will say, and the big takeaway of why the vice chair mentioned that, is that we want to make it absolutely clear that our committee takes witness tampering, witness intimidation very seriously, and that it can't be done inside of a vacuum where we don't find out about it. We are finding out about these things, and we will do the appropriate thing, referring it to the Department of Justice as is required. So, I don't want to say a lot more about that on the specifics around the witnesses, but I think the big takeaway is that we take it very seriously, and folks shouldn't believe that they can do this without consequences.
It had been reported that the committee was in possession of metadata, which suggests phone logs. Do you have all of the visibility that you would like into not just the logs, but the contents of Donald Trump's calls on the day of January 6th?
We have a lot of information, and I think the combination of data as well as witness testimony helps us understand a bit more about who the president was communicating with on that day.
The call with Steve Bannon and then the public utterances of Steve Bannon make abundantly clear he's a foot soldier in marshaling the crowds on January 6th. Can you say more about the people, sort of the off-book operation Donald Trump, who was at the time our country's commander-in-chief, was running with a very different chain of command with the militia groups and his lieutenants who seemed to be commanding and controlling them?
Well, we took you into the room for a very bizarre meeting in the White House where you saw that there were a set of outside advisors, not government officials, who were kind of battling with the White House counsel and others who are White House staff over dangerous and possibly unconstitutional ideas. And that was a little bit of par for the course for this administration. There was always sort of an outside set of advisors who didn't have an official role within the government. And I think you would include in that some of the people you heard about in the hearing today, Roger Stone and Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell. These were people who were peddling dangerous ideas to the president, and they had his ear.
What should we expect in terms of Pat Cipollone's testimony? It was, expectations were managed, if you will. I know he spent 8 hours with the committee, but it wasn't clear if he was a compelling storyteller. And it's clear from just the clips we saw today that he painted a very detailed picture of this meeting you're talking about on December 18th. There's the back and forth with Sidney Powell, where she sort of mocks at the speed at which he sought to blow up the meeting. Was he able to corroborate everything that we heard from Cassidy Hutchinson? And is there more that he was able to talk about?
I believe Sidney Powell said that he set a land speed record for how fast he tried to get to the White House, into that room and have somebody who was White House staff in that room. You know, Pat Cipollone provided us a lot of relevant information, but as you could also see, we had also talked to other folks who were in the White House counsel staff, Eric Hirschman, Derek Lyons, and others. And so we combined those testimonies to be able to build a more holistic picture of some of the conversations that were had. And I think you're going to see more in the next hearing, and we'll be bringing Mr. Cipollone back in and or bringing his testimony back into our hearings to shine additional light on what happened in those very critical 187 minutes when the Capitol was under attack and the president sat in the White House.
Congresswoman, this is Katie Turr. I've got a question again about phone calls and the link you can make between Mike Lindell knowing that Donald Trump was going to spontaneously call for a march to the Capitol, and same with Alexander, knowing about this. How did they know this? Is there a phone call between either one of them and somebody within the White House? Does a phone log show that Donald Trump had a conversation with Mike Lindell about this in the days leading up to January 6th? How did they know that he was going to say it?
Well, with Lindell, Katrina Pearson is the one who emailed him, I believe, and said, this is what the president is going to do. As it relates to Ali Alexander, I don't know. But what I do know is that the president knows who Ali Alexander is and had spoken about him in previous meetings to the January 6th. So, you know, I think our investigation continues. We continue to interview witnesses and gather data. And I think there are lots of points of interest that I know that we'll be investigating to see if we can't get a little more color and context on.
Will we see a phone tree, like a phone log of all the calls that were made from the White House on that day? I know you had a couple with Steve Bannon the day before. Are we going to see more on the day of?
I think what we really try to do is to pull the pieces of information we have that is most relevant to the narrative that we are sharing with the American people. We have so much information that to share the entire White House phone log wouldn't exactly be productive. But as it relates and supports to the points that we are trying to make, we will be relying on those types of pieces of evidence.
Congresswoman, a hearing for next week was confirmed today in today's public hearing. Should we expect to be surprised after that? Are you still in receipt of new testimony, new evidence, and new witnesses?
I guess I would say that each one of our hearings has contained surprises, and we are full of surprises. So I hope you'll tune in next week.
We will. And I guess what I hear you saying is buy only refundable car rentals or any sort of summer travel. It was a day of incredible revelations. Congressman Stephanie Murphy, I imagine it's been a long day. I'm grateful to you for taking some time to talk to Katie and myself. Thank you.
It was great to be with you.
Thank you very much. So the committees that get to this point is more forthcoming with what they have and less afraid to say, yeah, we got that. And yeah, we got more.
It seems for a while they really did not want to set expectations too high. They wanted to...
Except Raskin saying we're going to blow the roof off.
Other than that, but I wonder if somebody got to him because suddenly everybody got very tight-lipped. But they've been very cautious in how they have described what is coming up because they understand that if they set the bar too high and they don't deliver on it, the American public is going to say, well,
Tune out.
Is not what I expected it to be. They've done a very good job so far of laying it all out. And I just want to go back and just remind everybody all that we've seen so far, Nicole, which is that Donald Trump was told over and over again that he lost the election by everybody in his orbit, without any authority, anybody who was in a position to know. Bill Barr, you lost the election. Pat Cipollone, you lost the election. Ivanka, I believe Bill Barr, you lost lost the election. Everybody in and around him was telling him the same thing. You can't go after Mike Pence. He doesn't have the authority. Right. You can't go after the state representatives because they've done the recounts, and the recounts show that you don't have the votes. You can't do it. You can't pressure the DOJ. If you install Jeffrey Clark, we're all going to resign. You can't do this. Sidney Powell comes in and says, we're going to do an executive order, make me special counsel. Right. He decides not to do that, I guess.
Well, he kind of does it,
but doesn't totally follow through with it. And then he moves on to the next thing, which is, I'm going to look at January 6th. And January 6th is the day they're going to certify the election. I'm going to send out a tweet, and I'm going to get people to go to my rally.
To pressure Pence. And I'm going to work Pence myself.
Did he know that they would then march to the Capitol? Seems like yes, from what we're seeing.
Yeah.
And did he know what they would do when they marched to the Capitol? Did he understand that 1 + 1 = 2?
I think after your math lesson, the answer is yes. I think the other thing that we heard today, and I know we've seen a lot of Cassidy Hutchinson, but I hadn't heard her quite reveal Mark Meadows' radicalization in terms of the lack of, I mean, the other thing that you hear over and over is that there was never any evidence. There was never any evidence of voter fraud. There was never any in the states. There was never any at DOJ. There was never anything wrong with any of the voting machines. And no one could argue that there was. I mean, you heard Rusty Bowers come back and say, yeah, Rudy said they had theories. That was Rudy. You heard Cassidy Hutchinson say that Mark Meadows went from being intrigued by whether or not there was evidence to intrigued by the constitutional loopholes.
You know, what I find interesting is we're hearing from all these aides now in this testimony under oath with 2020 vision. I wonder if Donald Trump was able to find a constitutional loophole.
Well, Eastman found it, right?
Find some way to stay in office. Yeah. If something happened that kept him in the Oval Office, it wouldn't have been legal. But if he were able to stay, would all those people who said that they knew that it was over and that they were trying to tell him it was over and they were just trying to give him some space, would they still be working for him today?
Right. Well, we know that no one usually quit. I mean, some quit on January 6th.
Nobody quit until January 6th, until the violence actually happened.
Right.
Had that not happened, would they have stayed on? I find it really interesting that a lot of these folks all seem to know better now and are willing to say it, at least under oath, but weren't willing to say it at the time. I mean, Bill Barr saying that he wasn't doing a service to democracy and to the country or to his supporters. Why didn't he say that in real time?
And Bill Barr
tell us that in the moment?
In for Trump 2024 if he runs again.
And then a lot of them are saying that they'd vote for him again, which I also find really amazing. The guy was threatening democracy, but yeah, I'll vote for him again.
It's unbelievable. It's chattering. We should tell our viewers what I did here. You were in here because you were covering, and I grabbed you from the other side and pulled you over.
Thank you very much. Katie's been sitting for 4 hours.
No, she's been watching. I want to hear from you. So I'm sorry. I'm sorry if any babysitters had to stay late or anything. Thank you very much. We're going to sneak in a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We'll be back with so much more of today's testimony and all of our favorite reporters and friends.
Consider how millions of Americans were persuaded to believe what Donald Trump's closest advisors in his administration did not. These Americans did not have access to the truth like Donald Trump did. They put their faith and their trust in Donald Trump. They wanted to believe in him. They wanted to fight for their country, and he deceived them.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in 3 key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations. And they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
I want to start by asking if you agree, Mr. Cipollone, with the conclusions of Matt Morgan, of Bill Barr, of all of the individuals who evaluated those claims, that there is no evidence of election fraud sufficient to undermine the outcome in a particular state.
Yes, I agree with that. If your question is that I believe we should concede the election at a point in time, yes, I did.
December 14th, was the day that the states certified their votes and sent them to Congress. And in my view, that was the end of the matter. I didn't see, you know, I thought that this would lead inexorably to a new administration.
The efforts to overturn the election should have stopped once the litigation was complete.
In my view, upon the conclusion of litigation was when I began to plan for life after the administration.
I told him that I did believe, yes, that once those legal processes were run, if fraud had not been established, that had affected the outcome of the election, then unfortunately, I believed that what had to be done was concede the outcome.
A crush of evidence there shown by the January 6th Select Committee in their public hearing today. Of all of the people around Donald Trump, it's hard to find anyone who disagreed with the consensus opinion that he had lost and he should concede. Let's bring into our coverage Luke Broadwater, New York Times congressional reporter. He was inside the room during today's hearing. Tell me from your vantage point as a reporter who has covered every twist and turn of the story, what jumped out at you today?
I was pretty shocked at some of the text messages and communications they had that showed that Donald Trump had wanted to march to the Capitol and had wanted to keep this plan secret from a larger group of people. That to me was perhaps the most revelatory. I hadn't seen those text messages before. We knew that Donald Trump, it was known Donald Trump did want to go to the Capitol. Obviously, he commands the mob to go there on January 6th. But the fact that days ahead of time, key rally organizers are saying this is going to be an unexpected announcement and we can't spread this too widely and we can't let the National Park Police know, that added a level of sort of clandestine behavior that I think adds an extra layer onto what we already know about the way Trump was acting around January 6th, that he didn't want too many of his most sober advisors to know about what he was planning to do with the crowd, directing them to the Capitol. That was probably my largest takeaway. Obviously, the implication from Liz Cheney that there was potential witness influencing or witness tampering going on by the former president was a major development. And we also learned a lot more information about that completely crazy December 18th meeting inside the Oval Office. And then I think we saw also Donald Trump's power over the crowd, about how he could command them to go to the Capitol, but he could also command them to leave. We saw testimony. The American people heard testimony for the first time from a rioter who said, basically, when Trump told us to go home, we went home. He could call off the crowd. And so I think those are some pretty major revelations that we heard today.
It's such a good point. I'm going to play this again. This is thought number one. I thought this was the most sort of tantalizing thing that we learned as well, that there was almost a sidebar of communication between Trump and the rally organizers. They know this. POTUS is going to call for it unexpectedly. Let me play that.
The organizer says, you know, this stays between us. We're having a second stage at the Supreme Court again after the ellipse. POTUS is going to have us march there / the Capitol. It cannot get out about the second stage because people will try and set up another and sabotage it. It can also not get out about the march because I will be in trouble with the National Park Service and all the agencies. But POTUS is going to just call for it, quote, unexpectedly. The end of the message indicates that the president's plan to have his followers march to the Capitol was not being broadly discussed.
So this, for me, Luke, brought back all of Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony about movements, about presidential movements that are planned and presidential movements that are OTR. And then Liz Cheney has her go through what's an OTR movement. It's clear that they're building to what the organizers were told to expect, which was a movement from Donald Trump to the Capitol.
Right. That's right. And we knew that. Even that morning from Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony that Donald Trump was agitating at Mark Meadows and others to try to get him to the Capitol. And Mark Meadows was sort of putting it off and telling him we haven't we're going to try to make it happen. And then he sort of redirected the president to the Secret Service. And then we heard about the blow up in the Secret Service SUV as Donald Trump is trying to go to the Capitol against the better advice from the people around him. So, yeah, I think that is an important development because it does get to the ratcheting up of the crowd, which Donald Trump, according to testimony, knew was armed, knew potentially wanted to commit violence, and yet he wanted them to go to the Capitol anyway. And in fact, he wanted to lead them. So, you know, I think that was a major development.
So, Frank, again, pairing what Luke and I are talking about with Cassidy Hutchinson's very inside knowledge. I mean, she was in on and involved in the two halves of any White House, which is operational and sort of policy and planning. So she sat right next to the security guy and sort of the deputy chief of staff for operations. She's already testified to all of this commotion around a desired OTR from the president. What we learned from that piece of evidence that Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy puts out there is that the rioters were in on an OTR, which is on top of everything that it is. It's his participation in a coup plot. It's his participation in an armed insurrection against the government. It's his presence at the Capitol where they want to hang Mike Pence. It's also an incredible security breach.
All of the above. And why is it important from an investigative prosecutive standpoint? Because intent to conceal can be used. It's not definitive, but it certainly can be used as evidence of knowledge of criminality. Why do you want to hide something you're doing if it's perfectly fine? It's really hard for the president, the former president, to be able to talk his way out of that. Well, I certainly didn't want to upset the Park Service. Really? That's what was driving you in hiding all of this? I think not. So prosecutors will tell you intent to conceal can be used as evidence that of knowledge of criminality. So it's really important. And then with regard to this, you know, a presidency filled with security risks, threats and exposures every single day. He casts caution to the wind and says, I want to go even to blow up in that SUV, demanding to go to the Capitol. He's got to force the ending, as they say in studying cults, right? When things aren't going the cult's way, the members force the end. He was trying to force the end because he wasn't getting his way, and everything around him, thank goodness, held the Secret Service. Folks like Pat Cipollone, again, whether you like him or you don't like him, Attorney General Barr, like him, don't like him, the things held, and the cumulative effect of that was we didn't have the Insurrection Act declared because Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, they were waiting for the Insurrection Act to be declared. And then, yes, all hell would have broken loose.
And Claire, one of the services of today's public hearing was the live testimony from a former Oath Keeper who said what Frank just said, that they exist. They exist in waiting for someone like Donald Trump to come along and run a government, run an off-book government where they are the de facto militia, military. To Frank's point and to everything we heard today, it came hauntingly close to happening.
Yeah, I think both of the witnesses performed a really important function in the committee's work. The one witness explained that the Oath Keepers are very dangerous, but you add Trump to the equation and they become deadly. And somebody who's willing to play to them and to play to their worst instincts. The other witness I think is really important. And I think this is what Liz Cheney and the other committee members have been geniuses about. The next hearing is going to be about that 181 minutes. Why is that important? Because we had a witness. It's probably like thousands of others in that crowd that said very simply, why did he come to Washington? Because Trump asked him to. Yeah. Why did he march to the Capitol? Because Trump told him to in the speech. And importantly, why did he leave the Capitol?
Yeah.
He left the Capitol because Trump told him to. So Trump, by refusing to act, shows more evidence of his desire to see violence and chaos only to hold on to power.
Yeah, and it's something that we heard from the leaked tapes of Kevin McCarthy. He knew that only Trump could make them go home. It's something Chris Christie said on national television on the day. Trump needs to tell them to go home. Everyone knew that the insurrection would or could have stopped if Trump told them to stop.
Another incredible day of testimony. We're so lucky to have all of you. Luke Brawbutter, Frank Figluzzi, Claire McCaskill, thank you so much for joining us for the hour. Our special coverage continues. We'll play more from today's stunning hearing. And we also will have a chance to speak to another member of the Select Committee about what comes next. It's right after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York on another wild day of news and developments. We are continuing our special coverage of the 7th public hearing by the January 6th Select Committee. An extraordinary look deep inside exactly how Trump supporters and far-right extremist groups were spurred into action by Donald Trump's repeated lies about election fraud, and specifically how his tweet on December 19th saying about January 6th, be there, will be wild, turned out to be an explosive invitation heard all around the world. But a huge revelation from today's presentation was what took place the night before that tweet actually went out, where an astonishing clash went down between White House attorneys on one side and Trump, should we call them outside advisors, on the other. People like Sidney Powell and Michael Flynn, people who were feeding the ex-president lies about how the election had been conducted. Take a listen to White House officials describe that scene that night.
I remember the three of them were really sort of forcefully attacking me verbally. Derek, and we were pushing back and we were asking one simple question as a general matter. Where is the evidence?
I think that it got to the point where the screaming was completely out there. I mean, again, people walk in, it was late at night, it had been a long day, and what they were proposing, I thought was nuts. Flynn screamed at me that I was a quitter and everything, kept on standing up and turning around and screaming at me. And at a certain point, I had it with him. So I yelled back, either come over or sit your effing ass back down.
At the end of the day, we landed where we started the meeting, at least from a structural standpoint, which was Sidney Powell was fighting. Mike Flynn was fighting. They were looking for avenues that would enable, that would result in President Trump remaining President Trump for a second term.
A stunning situation that Mark Meadows' former aide Cassidy Hutchinson described in texts that were also shared with the public as unhinged. Today, we also heard from a man named Stephen Ayers. He's one of the people who stormed the United States Capitol on January 6th and who last month pleaded guilty to one federal charge of disorderly conduct inside a restricted building. Mr. Ayers described just how much he was influenced by the ex-president's lies.
You heard from President Trump that the election was stolen. How did that make you feel?
Oh, I was very upset, as were most of his supporters. That's basically what got me to come down here.
And do you still believe the election was stolen?
Not so much now. I got away from all the social media when January 6th happened, basically deleted it all. I started doing my own research and everything.
Would it have made a difference to you to know that President Trump himself had no evidence of widespread fraud?
Oh, definitely. You know, who knows? I may not have come down here.
And in a really remarkable moment, as soon as the hearing wrapped, that gentleman, Mr. Ayers, hugged the officers who defended the Capitol on the 6th. They've been in almost all of these hearings. Harry Dunn, Aquilino Gannell, Michael Fanone, and Daniel Hodges. Our NBC reporter in the room heard him say to the officers, "I'm really sorry." The end of today's hearing also brought a shocking bombshell from Vice Chair of the committee, Liz Cheney. Watch.
After our last hearing, President Trump tried to call a witness in our investigation, a witness you have not yet seen in these hearings. That person declined to answer or respond to President Trump's call and instead alerted their lawyer to the call. Their lawyer alerted us, and this committee has supplied that information to the Department of Justice. Let me say one more time, we will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously.
It's where we begin our coverage this hour with some of our most favorite reporters and friends. Jackie Alemany is here, Washington Post congressional investigations reporter, also an MSNBC contributor. Miles Taylor's back, former DHS chief of staff during the Trump administration. He's now the founder and executive director of the Renew America movement. And Harry Lipman's here, former U.S. attorney, former deputy assistant attorney general. He's now the host of the fabulous Talking Feds podcast. Jackie, I've been starting with the reporters to make sure that I didn't miss anything that you're ears might have caught. Take me inside what you think the committee achieved in terms of not just what we heard right there, implicating Donald Trump in a witness tampering incident that has now been referred to the Department of Justice, but in terms of all the connective tissue that was expected and was produced between Donald Trump, his closest allies and advisors, and the extremists themselves.
Yeah, Nicole, that was really quite an emotional roller coaster, I think, for me and for the American public. I think the committee did an extremely effective job at sort of taking us through the swings of these surreal, almost comedic moments to, in the next flash of a moment, these very panicked fears about a potential insurrection and attempts at actually fomenting a coup taking place at the White House in the Oval Office on December 18th. And in the lead up to January 6th. The committee really laid out this sort of pivot that the former president made after December 14th towards looking at extrajudicial, unconstitutional avenues in order to hold on to his power, and the desperation that took place in all of these various directions with these fringe players, people like Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell, Patrick Byrne, that Overstock.com guy, as Pat Cipollone called him, to then putting out tweets and seeing how that reverberated in the extremist ecosystem and actually spurred action. The committee then did a really fantastic job of connecting that to other players like Twitter, other parties that were potentially responsible in some way for getting these extremists to actually breach the Capitol. People who knew along the way that it was problematic, that violence was being fomented and encouraged in some way, but turned a blind eye because of the former president's power. I think in the broader legal scheme of things, we've heard about two crimes that the former president potentially committed, an attempt to obstruct Congress and defraud the American public. But one of the crimes that is much harder to prove that I think came into play today as a result of some of these findings and these links between extremist groups and Trump allies is that this seditious conspiracy. And some of these players that people like Roger Stone, Michael Flynn, Rudy Giuliani were in touch with have already been sentenced on criminal charges of seditious conspiracy. So I think it raises the specter of what the Department of Justice is potentially looking at. And then in the end, they wrapped it all up by putting an extremely human touch on things, by showing that Trump's words directly impacted the people who ultimately breached the Capitol and the people who were affected as a result of that breach. We ended with a really extraordinary goosebump-inducing moment of watching Stephen Ayers, an insurrectionist who went up to these police officers, Aquilino Gannell, Michael Fanone, Harry Dunn, the widow of Officer Smith, Aaron Smith, and Officer Officer Hodges and apologized to them and expressed his condolences. Obviously, there, you know, it remains to be seen whether those officers accept his apology, but it was a really surreal and emotional moment in the room.
Roller coaster is the perfect word for it. Harry Lipman, I found myself watching, and I know Trump supporters, and so I found myself watching Mr. Ayers and feeling like, oh my God, there were so many people who believed the lies he was telling them. And at least, obviously, Mr. Ayers is responsible for everything that he did. He seemed to take responsibility for that. But it seemed important to both Congressman Raskin and Congresswoman Cheney and Congresswoman Murphy to make clear that they were also victims, that their lives were also upended, not just by the lies, but what they did in service to the lies.
Yeah, I agree. They really did put a human touch on it, even to the people who were acting on his behalf. And he was, in some ways, was Trump a sort of supporting player here? We found out a few nuggets. There's the statement in the December 18th meeting, which is an amazing meeting that it's crazy the chief of staff let happen. There's his rewriting of the speech and adding all this stuff about Pence. But otherwise, he doesn't figure in as much, except, look, there are always ragtag terrorists out there. I've prosecuted them. There are people who are deluded or believe in a charismatic leader. What they aren't, however, are normally following the direct commands of the president of the United States. So in some ways, even though he's the supporting player here, he really is the looming factor in the background that is making everything happen. And that's what gives rise to the potential charges that Jackie is talking about.
Yeah, well, I haven't done this yet because we came on the air right as the hearings were ending, but I want to deal with the beast that is this meeting. This December 18th meeting figured very prominently, we get to read along. It was one of those things that even as you're reading the transcript of it, your jaw's on the ground, and then to see it was just stunning. So I'm going to play different pieces of it. Let me start with sort of the clash between Cipollone and Sidney Powell, which is, for the purposes of the coup, are sort of Trump's better angels and you know, the other one on his shoulder. Let me play SOT number three first.
Do you recall whether he raised to Ms. Powell the fact that she and the campaign had lost all of the 60 cases that they had brought in litigation?
Yes, he raised that.
And what was the response?
I don't remember what she said. I don't think it was a good response.
Cipollone and Hirschman and whoever the other guy was showed nothing but contempt and disdain of the president.
Yeah, I remember. The three of them were really sort of forcefully attacking me verbally. Derek, and we were pushing back and we were asking one simple question as a general matter. Where is the evidence? So
what response did you get when you asked Ms. Powell and her colleagues where's the
a variety of responses based on my current recollection, including, you know, can't believe you would say something like, you know, things like this, like, what do you mean, where's the evidence? You should know, you know, and things like that, or, you know, a disregard, I would say, a general disregard for the importance of actually backing up what you say with facts.
So the shiny object here is the lunacy of this meeting, and it sounds like it's verbally incredibly intense, but we know from Eric Hirschman there's also a threat, you know, to Mike Flynn to get up and throw down at one point, which is an argument for all women running the world, but we'll do that another day. I want to ask you, Miles, I mean, the fact that even the craziest of Trump's backers couldn't even off the top of their head throw out any evidence seems like the other significant piece of Cipollone's testimony.
And Nicole, some of the key watchwords in this hearing were, where is the evidence? I think it's so telling that it wasn't just hours or days or weeks. It was months of there not being evidence. And the president of the United States driving the democratic process right to the brink. I mean, this episode in the Oval Office feels like a B Hollywood movie. You wouldn't even imagine Aaron Sorkin in the West Wing thinking to write something like this, because it was never until now, until the Trump administration, conceivable that a conversation like this could happen in the Oval Office. It was exceptionally chilling to see, and to see how close we got, that there was a handful of lawyers standing in the way, and that in a lot of ways, Just Say No Pat Cipollone was one of the reasons that it didn't go further. But even still, the president was inclined to believe this cauldron of crazy people that he had surrounded himself with. I'll note another watchword, Nicole, from this hearing was the word civil war. It was very, very jarring to see a member of the Oath Keepers reference civil war, to see text messages from Trump's own campaign manager, previous campaign manager, Brad Parscale, saying that this was akin to the president, exhorting people towards a civil war. But we all know, Nicole, and we've talked about on this program, that Trump himself has talked about civil wars being afoot. And this has an impact, right? 65% of Southern Republicans today believe that their state should secede from the union. This is having a very perverse, warped impact on our politics. And you can see how it instigated people to come storm the U.S. Capitol. The last thing I want to note on that front is a third watchword, and that is insurrection. As Jackie noted at the top end, the references to the Insurrection Act aren't something that was new and novel in the lead up to January 6th. As you and I have talked about many times, Trump for years had fantasized about using the Insurrection Act to exert his powers to the maximum extent, because he had been told by lawyers he essentially could declare martial law if there was ever an insurrection. So it was very present in his mind that if such a scenario transpired, he might be able to exert additional presidential powers, and in this case, potentially delay handover of power to a new administration.
Joining our conversation is Congresswoman Elaine Loria of Virginia. She, of course, is a member of the House January 6th Select Committee. Congresswoman, thank you for being with us. NBC has just learned that the next hearing has been announced and scheduled for next Thursday night in prime time. Your fellow committee members gave a little bit of a preview, but it's clear that with the addition of Pat Cipollone's deposition, there is just a cascade or a crush of high-level White House officials testifying to what has been a theme through everything, that Trump lost, Trump was told he lost, his plot to overturn the election was illegal, Trump knew it was illegal. And today what was introduced was a real bulk of knowledge tying Trump to the extremists and their conduct. Tell us what we should expect to be built on or enhanced or what we should understand better next week.
Well, as you discussed today, we talk through the lead up, the call to D.C., what brought people here. We had a witness who himself, heard that call and answered it and came to D.C. and was remorseful after the fact. And all of the different pieces that came together to have this violent mob attacking the Capitol, and what we're going to go into during our hearing next week that I'm going to lead with my colleague Adam Kenzinger is the 187 minutes, what happened during that time frame from when the president walked off the stage at the Ellipse, and the inaction during that time frame that allowed this violence to go on for 187 minutes until he finally walked out to the Rose Garden and made a statement. And we'll contrast that statement between, you know, what was prepared by his official White House staff and the remarks that he actually gave at that point in time, because to me, those remarks really, in a way, condone the actions of those rioters and the fact that he commiserates with them. We understand, you know, this is the kind of thing that happens, you know, when an election is stolen, the kind of language that he uses. And, you know, it was alluded to today as well through Mr. Cipollone's testimony that, you know, there was a flurry of action to try to get him to do something during that time frame. And, you know, myself and Mr. Kenzinger as veterans, you know, we're going to focus a lot on what the oath means to those people who serve in uniform, people who now serve in public office. And this was really a dereliction of duty on the part of the former president. And so that's where we will take the next hearing.
I apologize that our camera location there is noisy. There's nothing more important, though, than hearing from you. And I do want to ask, actually, may I play some of one of the live witnesses' testimony? He seemed to be issuing almost a warning to anyone who thinks that the threat isn't ongoing. For my team, this is number two, and this is Mr. Van Tattenhoff on our need, all of us, as sort of a political culture, and I took it as a note to all reporters, to stop mincing words. Let me play that.
I think we need to quit mincing words and just talk about truths. And what it was going to be was an armed revolution. I mean, people died that day. Law enforcement officers died this day. There was a gallows set up in front of the Capitol. This could have been the spark that started a new civil war, and no one would have won there. That would have been good for no one. He was always looking for ways to legitimize what he was doing, whether by wrapping it in the trappings of it's not a militia, it's a community preparedness team. We're not a militia, we're an educational outreach group. It's a veteran support group. But again, we've got to stop with this dishonesty and the mincing of words and just call things for what they are. You know, he's a militia leader. He had these grand visions of being a paramilitary leader, and the Insurrection Act would have given him a path forward with that. You know, the fact that the president was communicating, whether directly or indirectly, messaging, you know, kind of that gave him the nod. And all I can do is thank the gods that things did not go any worse that day.
Congresswoman Luria, he's speaking about Stuart Rhodes. He was his spokesperson, and he explained how he broke with the Oath Keepers before the January 6th insurrection. But I wonder if the committee is able to make that link to who was communicating with Stuart Rhodes and the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys in terms of that 181 minutes that we'll look at next week.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing I'd like to say, and thank you for playing that clip, because that was very powerful, and I think those were words that needed to be said. I think that people do need to stop essentially whitewashing this and trying to make it something that it wasn't. And you know, some of the critics of the investigation, the committee itself, have said, you know, why are you looking at something that happened 18 months ago? And I keep saying over and over again, the truth is that the danger still exists. The things that brought people to Washington, the extremist groups, the kind of rhetoric, the fact that people, you know, are still denying the results of the last election, they're still a danger. They're a danger today as far as violence is concerned, and they're a danger for the future of our election. So I just wanted to highlight that. And, you know, throughout today's hearing, and I said yesterday when I was on with Chris Hayes, it's like a Venn diagram that we've put together. We showed today these encrypted communications that happened, you know, between those people in Trump's orbit, like Roger Stone and these leaders mm-hmm. of these, you know, domestic extremist groups. And we showed, you know, the people from these groups providing security to the people like Roger Stone and General Flynn. And, you know, as the witness you just showed said, you know, whether it was directly or indirectly or signaling, you know, all of these pieces are coming together. And Mr. Raskin, as he said, we just showed a small part of the evidence that we've gathered through our mm-hmm. investigation. And so we'll continue to dig into that and make these connections, you know, fill out that Venn diagram of where this information was flowing, who was in the sphere of these people. And, you know, it just, like I mentioned earlier, it's a clear danger that still exists today.
As you're speaking, I'm thinking of the three pardons that Trump gives out and the prominent role that the pardoned people, Mike Flynn, Steve Bannon, and Roger Stone play in the coup. Do you have any evidence of anything that transpires around the delivering of those pardons and their roles in January 6th?
I don't have any direct evidence. It's a great point, though. You know, it couldn't be more clear from what we just covered in the hearing today
right.
that of the people who were pardoned, there were three key players who figured prominently in today's hearing. So it's certainly, you know, something that bears more attention.
When you have evidence of witness tampering and it includes Donald Trump and it's made public, is it intended to put more pressure? I mean, the committee as a whole seems I don't know if out of patience is the right word, or exasperated or disgusted sometimes in what feels like a lack of action out of DOJ. Can you characterize the views of the Department of Justice's investigations and prosecutions of the crimes that have been detailed by the committee?
Well, what I'd say is that, you know, from a personal perspective, I feel like the pace of that is picking up. I had made some comments earlier directly related to those people who defied subpoenas from Congress because we really wanted to hear from those witnesses. So I said to, you know, the Attorney General, please do your job so we can hear from these people so we can do ours. But, you know, these charges of seditious conspiracy, the reporting that we, you know, are aware of the people who've been interviewed and, you know, who are, you know, being questioned by the Department of Justice, I feel like that pace is picking up. And, you know, it is a good sign. You know, the Attorney General, he said directly after our first hearing, I'm listening to what the committee is saying, and we're putting a lot of evidence out there. You know, so I, you know, do believe that they're taking this seriously. I can't really comment because I don't have, you know, play-by-play information on how those investigations are going. But, you know, about the witness tampering aspect of, I mean, you know, as far as being a committee who's conducting an investigation, and now we have an indication again that one of the people who's spoken to the committee has been approached, and in this case, directly by the former president, you know, with words of caution or intended to speak to them about their testimony. I mean, it brings into question, like, what other kind of pressuring? What about witnesses who have spoken to us? What's, you know, what kind of pressure was applied? And, you know, have we gotten the full information from them? I'm speculating, but, you know, with pressure being applied, you know, from different places towards those who've spoken to, who've sought to come forward and give us the truth.
If you look at the evidence that Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy shared of an insurrectionist, a protester or a rally organizer, knowing that not only that Trump would call on them to go to the Capitol, would say he would go, but and that it wasn't supposed to be widely known. That's a security move called an OTR. Cassidy Hutchinson explained it in her public testimony. And I remember from working in the White House that nobody in the White House really knows when they're happening for operational security concerns. Is the evidence building to put Trump at least inside the seditious conspiracy in terms of the evidence that you've marshaled and the suggestion that he be investigated as part of that conspiracy?
Well, you know, it was very poignant, the information that we got today, that there was, it was known. It was known to people. It was known to people within these, you know, DVEs, the folks who were spreading, you know, the message to get to D.C., that there was going to be this movement. But, you know, hush, hush, don't tell anybody ahead of time. We're keeping this on the down low. And then the president acts as though it's a spontaneous thing. So that's, you know, something that is really important to look at and draw that connection. And, you know, it, one thing that really touched me about this, and I just wanted to have a chance to say this, is the thing that wasn't even planned by the committee that happened spontaneously at the end. When you had Mr. Ayers approach the four officers who had testified at our first hearing, and here you have someone who was, you know, who answered that call to come to D.C., who participated in the violence, and the officers who, you know, directly received injuries because of that. And, you know, the apology that he made, and it seemed like, you know, there's some level of reconciliation on an individual basis. But, you know, that moment kind of gave me this hope that maybe there can be some greater reconciliation, you know, across the division that we see here that was exhibited by the riot itself, you know, against our establishment of our government and our democracy. It's just like a little symbol, maybe, of something that could be a brighter light in the future.
Well, and importantly, Mr. Ayers testified to quitting social media after January 6th and doing his own research. So it had at its foundation a purging of all the disinformation and lies, which, you know, is one of the missions of the committee itself. Congresswoman Elaine Luria, thank you for spending some time with us on these days. I know they're very long ones for you. We're grateful.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.